This is The Third Degree. I'm Jessica Minchell. Today we're looking at how industry regulations have changed, 3 years on from Australia's Montara oil spill. And we take a close look at what data journalism can do for environmental reporting. August 2009 saw the start of a large-scale oil spill in the Montara oil field in the Timor Sea, with oil slicks seeping into the ocean each day for the next 10 weeks. A new progress report by the federal government has looked at how well recommendations from their inquiry into the oil spill have been implemented. It suggests strengthening the principle of polluter pays, thereby making companies responsible for contamination associated with their productions. Chris Smythe is Healthy Oceans campaigner with the Australian Conservation Foundation.
The wellhead platform at the PTPP wellhead blew up, basically, and there's a very explosion, a fire, and eventually a leak of oil out into the Timor Sea. And that leak was at least 400 barrels a day. There was a great deal of debate about how much oil was being spilled, but it did cover a fairly extensive area of Timor Sea, and at the time ACF produced some maps of the scale of the area covered by the spill, and we actually transposed that against the coast of Sydney and the coast of Adelaide and Perth and Brisbane and so on. It actually was surprising how large it was, but because the Timor Sea is such a long distance away from our population centres, no one really knew much about it. In fact, the Gulf of Mexico spill, which occurred some time later, actually got far more media in Australia than the actual Montara wellhead. But at least it did generate a major response from government and from industry and from the community, and that's why the government's been working through a number of recommendations from a Montara inquiry to set up afterwards to see what needed to be done to sort out the sorts of problems in terms of occupational health, in terms of environmental health and so on, which the Montara wellhead platform explosion exposed.
And with that Montara oil spill, quite similarly to the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, it took a really long time to be able to stop that wellhead.
Took quite a couple of months to get it actually under control. And it was a very different situation to what happened in the Gulf of Mexico. That was an underwater well. And obviously the big difference between what happened in the Timor Sea and what happened in the Gulf of Mexico was that the oil found its way onto the beaches of Florida and those Gulf states and caused enormous damage to the tourism industry, the fishing industry, and just for the people who were living in those areas. And so if something like Montara had happened, say, off Sydney, then obviously the beaches of Sydney would have been seriously affected. It just happens that it happened in the Timor Sea, a long way from anywhere, but it doesn't mean to say it didn't have environmental damage. But one of the problems was that not a lot of monitoring was going on, and it was up to the groups like the WWF to go up there with their own boats and explore to see what was actually going on in terms of the impacts on ocean life up there. But again, there wasn't enough monitoring going on to really measure just how significant the impact was on ocean life up there.
And what sort of long-term impact has that spill, this Montara oil spill, had on the ocean environment?
Well, haven't seen any follow-up monitoring done of that area, so I can't really answer that question in any great detail. There were some deaths of ocean life recorded, but in small quantities, but we just don't know because this stuff gets ingested. You have migratory species travelling through there. It's very hard to really judge just how much impact there was on the ocean life up there. Obviously, the big lesson to learn is we just don't want to do this again because it could be worse the next time. But this was the biggest offshore petroleum incident in Australia's history. And that, I think, is one of the big drivers for legislative change, because it's as much about environmental health. The regulatory changes is also about occupational health and trying to protect the lives of people who work on these rigs.
And what were the inadequacies in the regulatory processes that you see or others see as having attributed to the level of damage caused?
Certainly the government has taken, certainly the regulatory bodies and the government have taken the company to task over the way in which the operations was established. Basically, what's happened since is that they've been trying to tighten up legislation not so basically as a response of what happened there, but also knowing that, well, we really need to tighten up these regulations because we don't want these things happening that frequently, rather than being just about possible failings in terms of the company. I think the government and the industry realised that they needed to tighten up generally the regulations to avoid these things from happening in the first place. And so one of the big problems was found was that all of the decisions were really delegated to state bodies. And so the operations of international companies in these Commonwealth waters, which started around about 5.5 kilometres offshore, being managed by state agencies. And the very clear message that came out of the Montara inquiry, which was in the case, it was the Northern Territory body, which was delegated to look after that, just wasn't up to the standard required. And so that really drove the regulatory change, which meant that a new body was established to regulate the industry from a occupational health and safety point of view, but also from a environmental point of view, and that's the and that was enshrined in legislation with amendments to the offshore petroleum legislation. And so they established what's called the National Offshore Petroleum Safety and Environmental Management Authority, which is quite a mouthful. But that really took away the powers of the state agencies and put it into one national body. And so all Commonwealth waters are now managed by one authority. That still means that the state waters are still managed by state bodies, which for us is really still a weakness. One of the problems we have right across our oceans is that we have this disintegrated management between state and Commonwealth jurisdictions and between sectors. And so we've got oil and gas legislation, we've also got fisheries legislation and so on, which are all sectoral sort of arrangements in jurisdictions, which really complicates things. And we're just a pity that the government couldn't go further and also look at ways in which they could have a national body which would actually look after all the waters.
And so what would that have meant for the Montara oil spill? Would that have then been within the federal jurisdiction?
Yes. So basically it's got to be outside the 5.5 kilometre limit. And so certainly with some of these recommendations of the Montara Inquiry, which has now been a report released in terms of how they've been progressing the recommendations, and the government has accepted most of the recommendations and has implemented most of them. But the big one obviously is the new authority. But there's also recommendations about streamlining the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, and that is a real worry for us because streamlining in industry terms is a bit different to what we might think might be streamlining. And even though the Montara incident encouraged the government to establish a national body which actually is going to manage all of Commonwealth waters and took away the powers of the states, in fact, with the amendments that we're looking at in terms of the federal environmental law, it's actually going to be giving powers back to the states in terms of environmental development approvals and so on. So it's quite ironic that the worst incident in Australia's offshore petroleum history, which generated a rethink of the way we actually how federal system works in terms of the Commonwealth and the state governments, and it actually strengthened things by taking away some of the powers of the states, we're actually now looking at change of the federal environmental law, which actually will reverse that, and not so much in the oil and gas industry, but actually in terms of other sort of development things, such as the coal industry boom in Queensland and so on, and port developments, increased shipping traffic associated with that, and the impacts it could have on the Great Barrier Reef, for instance. So it's just unfortunate that what we learned from Montara is we needed to actually make that sort of national environmental regulator to put that in place. We're now looking at breaking it all up again in terms of state and federal government relationships.
There was actually a governmental review into this bill, and those recommendations were handed down last year, and these are the recommendations you were just speaking about. And now a progress review has been released to document how these have been implemented. Part of this focuses on an idea of polluters pay for any environmental pollution as a result of an incident such as the Montara oil spill. How significant is that?
Well, I think it's an extremely significant principle to have enshrined in legislation. That's something certainly which we called for at the time that the government was looking into this process, that the polluters pays principle is just so important, because we can't allow industry to be working in what are our unique and fragile oceans without having that kind of regulation hanging over them to say, look, you've really got to make sure you do the right thing out there, because if you don't and there is an incident, you've got to pay for it. And obviously the ocean's going to pay for it, Australians will pay for it as well, but if there's going to be any cleanup, then that needs to be done by the person the company who actually caused that problem in terms of the pollution. So it's a principle which it should be just fundamental in any sort of environmental regulation and legislation.
And so the Thai-owned company PTEEP, which was responsible for the Mantara oil spill, they were not held accountable for the cost of that cleanup.
Well, they certainly had to pay for a lot of the costs of basically dismantling the rig and bringing in the various equipment they needed to do to try to cap the wellhead platform. In terms of all the emergency responses and so on, which the government had to, through the Australian Marine Safety Authority, Maritime Safety Authority, that obviously is for taxpayers. But obviously, if these things really do cost a large amount of money in terms of cleanup, in terms of damage to ocean life and so on, and we can put an estimate on those sorts of damages, then that's something which the company needs to pay. And because it was so far away from anywhere, because it's still unclear what sort of impacts it had, I guess most of the expenses were in terms of the basic cleanup operations of AMSA and obviously the cleanup operations for the company itself in terms of dismantling things and repairing things and so on. I'm not sure what the actual costs were in the end, but if these things, like, say, if it happened in other parts of Australia, which caused requirements for cleaning up of beaches, then obviously those costs should be borne by the company that's caused it. In Queensland, when there was an oil tanker spill, when a ship ran aground, there's oil spilled onto the beaches, that is something which actually has to go through various courts of law and so on, through sort of navigation acts and so on. And we just want to make sure that if there is going to be major costs associated with responding to these sorts of incidents, then it should be the industry which is responsible for it, the company which is responsible, it should be actually paying for it. And that's not just in terms of water pollution, same as air pollution, land development issues and so on, waste management, etc. If there's a problem caused, the community shouldn't have to clean up. It's something which should have been handled and managed by the company involved.
Is this a really different way of thinking about environmental regulation?
I think the polluters pays principle has been around for a very long time, and different countries have used it in different ways. It's just important that it's been acknowledged that it needs to be very much in the legislation to make sure that the industry is aware that that's the regulation that will be in play, that when they're actually going and going about their operations in terms of the ocean environment. And it's something, though, some of these things, it's a bit like the precautionary principle and those other principles we use to manage environmental issues. It's just one of those fundamental things we need to have in there so that it ensures that we can actually get the right things done. Obviously, you want to avoid these things from happening in the first place. And it's better to prevent rather than actually have to clean up. And so if these sorts of principles are there very clearly for the industry, then one would hope they're going to take things a lot more carefully. They're going to actually invest more in the sorts of things they need to do to prevent these things from happening.
That's Chris Smythe, Healthy Oceans Campaigner with the Australian Conservation Foundation. Data journalism maps are blooming across the media pages of the internet. But for all the effort involved, what can they contribute to news reporting and why have they taken off? Maureen Henninger is a senior lecturer in information and knowledge management at the University of Technology in Sydney. What data is available on the internet, how to seek it out and how to read it is her area of expertise.
Technologies have allowed this to happen, that's one. So we have some brilliant tools for visualising information and data. The second area would be the fact, from the point of view of data journalism, the shift from traditional media, as in print, to online. And once you have online media, then it is easy to, or relatively easy to, take the next step to interactivity. The best way of getting interactivity is to show somebody a map that they can actually play with. And I think that is the second move into the idea of data journalism. There's a third one which is actually very, very important, and that is the fact that we are now beginning to get a great deal of what is called PSI, public sector information. Governments are certainly being pressured to release more and more of this public information, particularly data, and also organizations such as the World Bank also providing their data. So once you get that confluence of the data is available, the technologies for visualizing it and analyzing it is available, and the move in journalism to having online platforms.
Do you think data journalism is going to improve the sort of journalism that's being done in any particular areas?
I think the answer to that is, from the point of view of just using a visualization to support a story, I think it could be any story, whether it is a popular magazine journalism or something a little bit more serious. I think its power is in investigative journalism, because you have, theoretically, a longer time to do your investigation, and perhaps the investigation, which is triggered by something, you then go and look at, you start gathering data and then being able to find what you need to investigate because of the data. So I would think that investigative journalism is probably the major area for data visualization, I think.
Just coming from an environmental journalism point of view, I can see great benefits in terms of being able to use data journalism to plot maps of where mines are located or exploration licenses are held for, or say contamination. And I know that you were working on a piece with UTS journalists students and the ABC called Coal Seam Gas by Numbers.
Yes.
Are you able to talk a little bit about that project?
I certainly can. I was the data consultant for that particular program. We started out thinking that it was about chemicals and the fracking process. That was in the news at the time, and that's where we got started. We, over the 4 months, and it did take 4 months of intensive work, we came to the conclusion that the story was about water and it was about salt. Now, that was an insight we had by looking at the data. This sort of project is not for the faint-hearted. One person cannot do it. Well, it's very difficult for one person to do it. For example, I'm not a journalist. I can find the data and I can visualize the data, but I can't do highly complex visualizations. So a project like that has to be a team effort.
And how did you find the story to be that relating to salt and water? How did the figures demonstrate that?
Partly it was intuition, I have to say. But when we started plotting on a map where the drilling was going on, even the capped mines, but where the mines were being drilled, and looking at it, we knew that it took water to do this. I mean, that was public knowledge. But when we overlaid, in the end, when we overlaid the locations of the mines over the map of Australia, we noted that it was right over the Great Artesian Basin. And we said, ooh, wait a moment. This is our largest, or one of our largest, supplies of water. So then we thought, okay, so how much water is this going to take? And from there, you know, in studying then, or in doing the research on the amount of water that is required, we started seeing, you know, that what was coming out was not only the gas, but what was coming out was, you know, the water that we that is pushed in, plus the water that is coming out and is being displaced. And we started looking at what people were saying about the water. We said, salt, all of this salt. So then that took us off to see how much salt. And we discovered that the amount of salt over 30 years would fill something like 15 mcgs, Melbourne Cricket Ground. That's a lot of salt. And it was that visualization. So, you know, it's intuition. It's picking up in my area, which is information management and information retrieval, I would call it berry picking. You know, you see little berries and you pick it and then you follow through that and it triggers. I guess that's probably how we came to that.
And have you been keeping an eye on how people have been using that website as a resource?
I have, or at least I did. I haven't looked at it for a while. I do know that some students, journalism students this semester, have been using it, but I don't know how much they're getting from it. So I guess the answer to that is I really don't know, but it would be interesting to look at any log analysis of that particular site.
And that was the first comprehensive data visualisation for coal seam gas within Australia. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any similar projects either within Australia or internationally that have done similar things?
Yeah. All right. First, it was the first piece of data journalism done anywhere in Australia. But that's not entirely true, but it was certainly one of the biggest ones. The New York Times did one about 2 years ago, particularly looking at coal seam gas in Pennsylvania. That's the one that I know best. There have been others, but not necessarily coal seam gas, but pollution. And USA Today did a very big one on pollution of all kinds of chemical plants, but not necessarily coal seam gas.
How closely connected do you think this idea of data journalism is and using techniques of data mining? How related do you think that is to ideas of then online privacy and anonymity, particularly at the moment we're seeing the National Security mm-hmm. Inquiry into looking at the policy yeah. of storing web browsing history on everyone yeah. for 2 years?
I've certainly been following the legislation. I know Australia wishes to be part of the European Council on data retention. I think if you are concerned about privacy, don't go anywhere near the internet. Google is storing, and I'm picking on Google, but all search engines will do this, Google is storing far more data than anything that the new legislation is going to save. I mean, underneath the Telecommunications Act, it's going to be storing the metadata. Well, you know, they've always stored the metadata. Of course, mind you, if there is a reason to mine that data, you do have to get the content as well. But that's out there. It's all out there. It's all public. I think since we have the internet, nothing is private. Absolutely nothing. So I'm not really fussed about it, I guess is my answer there. I'm not fussed about it.
That's not something that comes up in your courses in terms of journalists or students training to be journalists being concerned about how that could potentially influence their
sort of protection of sources or what they're researching?
It has not actually come up. I do try to show students that if they use only search engines, the use of private data or the digital identities that the search engines have given you by the profile of what you've been doing may skew the research that you do, that you are getting only what Eli Parisa calls the filter bubble. And I think I am very concerned with, not from privacy per se, and I hadn't really thought very much about the protection of sources. If you're doing it on the internet, those sources are public anyway. But possibly your question might be using email or Twitter to interrogate a source. I hadn't actually really thought very much about that. If you are really concerned about that, again, stay off the digital media.
That's Maureen Henninger, Senior Lecturer in Information and Knowledge Management at UTS. And if staying off the internet is not an option for you, we'll have more on the data retention laws and the National Security Inquiry over the next few weeks. This is The Third Degree. I'm Jessica Minchell, and you're listening to 2SER.